This is David Duke. This is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the world, worldwide, live. And ladies and gentlemen, this is a program dedicated to the interests, to the agenda, to the heritage, to the values, to the rights, to the freedom and the survival of the European people upon the planet. And I think it's valuable for all people. Our struggle as Europeans for the survival of our culture, of our very DNA, of the things that make us as we are, the things that give us the unique character, both the appearance, the culture, the art, the literature, the music, the architecture, the philosophy, the values of Western civilization, the things that make us unique are certainly worthy of preservation. And I believe that's true for all people around the world. Today I want to focus on the immigration problem to the United States of America, some of the Mexican immigration that's dramatically affecting the quality of life in the United States, the heritage of the people of the United States. And today I'm going to be drawing from a number of articles, but including an article from The Observer in the United States of America. So some of the words won't be mine, but certainly the ideas are those that reflect my ideas, and I will put a lot of my own words in this broadcast as well. But I just want to let that be known, and I want to talk to you today about the incredible cost of the illegal immigration that's coming in from Mexico into that country, our people, in many ways, ladies and gentlemen. Even for the Senate, the current immigration bill, the Hagel-Martinez immigration bill, is terrible. It includes a guest worker provision, an amnesty for many illegal aliens, and a large increase in legal immigration. Now, if you do a quick cost-benefit analysis, you'll find why it shafts the citizenry of the United States. Since 57% of the illegal immigrants are from Mexico, it is worth considering their effects upon our country. As a side note, 80 to 85% of Mexican immigrants are illegal, and 1 in 10 persons born in Mexico live in the United States. Now, the following information in this part of my broadcast comes from a 2001 study from the Center for Immigration Studies, and relies on data from the Census Bureau. As a group, Mexican immigrants suck up welfare benefits like a Hoover vacuum cleaner. While approximately 15% of natives used a major welfare program in the United States, Mexican immigrants used it more than twice that rate, 31%. One study by the National Academy of Sciences estimates that the average adult Mexican immigrant poses a net loss of $55,200 on the U.S. Now, that's taxes paid minus services cost. This tendency persists over time, since 30% of Mexican immigrants who have been here for more than 20 years use welfare benefits. Even third-generation Mexican-Americans are more than twice as likely as Native Americans to use welfare, and almost twice as likely to be in poverty or near the poverty level. Thus, Mexican immigrants and their descendants continue to suck up tax dollars. And let me point out to you that these are numbers that come from the American Census per se for all Americans. these numbers are skewed to a degree because the percentages on welfare are affected greatly by our large non-European American population. If you take European and American numbers by themselves, the Mexican percentage on welfare is absolutely horrendous as compared to the people of the United States, especially, again, the European American population. Now, the study I'm referring to underestimates the danger, because as medical costs spiral upward, the costs of these immigrants will also likely explode. Since 53% of Mexican immigrants, now again, we already gave you the figure, 55,000 loss per immigrant on average, ladies and gentlemen, that's for all. So when they tell you about immigrants contributing to the economy and so forth, it's just not true. All right, let's talk about medical insurance. Since 53% of Mexican immigrants don't have medical insurance, compared to 14% of Native Americans, and of course, even a smaller percent of European Americans don't have insurance, these costs threaten to break our ability to bail out Medicare and Social Security. And they certainly are a great factor in driving up medical costs because hospitals and the system have to provide services for these people that show up in the emergency rooms and show up for serious medical care. They provide those services free, while people who have to pay for them, members of the American citizenry, especially those who work and produce, well, they have to pay for them. These individuals don't, which drives up the cost, and of course it also drives up the insurance costs for those working Americans, to the point, of course, where many Americans can't even afford medical insurance anymore. Now, the legal Mexican immigrants, even legal Mexican immigrants, who have been in the United States for more than 20 years, are disproportionately uninsured. More than 33% don't have medical insurance. Now, there's no reason that we can reasonably expect this pattern to change over successive generations. Education is an important factor, an important indicator of how a group will affect others' pocketbooks, and Mexican immigrants as a group do very poorly in school. While 9% of Native Americans drop out of high school, a whopping 65% of Mexican immigrants do. And this pattern is multi-generational. Third-generation Mexican Americans are almost three times more likely than natives to drop out of high school and less than half as likely to graduate from college. Now, when you talk about our cultural life, when you talk about aspects of crime and the standards, really, which make life worth living and make a decent life for people in a country, the Mexican immigrants drag down standards even more. According to one study that used the Bureau of Justice Statistics, Hispanics are more than three times more likely than whites to commit violent crimes and three times more likely to be incarcerated. They also have a comparatively weak family structure, in that 36% of Hispanic births in the United States are out of wedlock. And when I say Hispanic, it's not really correct. We're not talking about people of Spanish descent in the United States of America. We're really talking about primarily the Mexican immigration and some of the other immigration that comes from certain Caribbean countries that may be called Hispanic. They may speak the Spanish language, but they're not truly Spanish Europeans. The Mexicans, for instance, are mostly mestizos. There are exceptions to that, but again, the vast majority are people who do not identify themselves as Europeans, certainly not as pure or essentially Spanish, but actually are non-European. Now, large numbers of these Mexicans don't even want to become citizens, but they're kind of taking us over. The kicker is that in 1997, only 15% of Mexicans qualified for naturalization and did so, whereas 53% from Europe and 44% from Asia did so. They're waiting, ladies and gentlemen, I think, to become citizens of this new country, of Ast land that they so desire. Reconquista is coming about. Now, what benefits outweigh these costs? Now, Senate apologists claim that amnesty is necessary to keep costs down. However, the Center for Immigration Studies suggests that Mexican immigration in the 90s reduced prices between 0.08% and 0.2%. This is because unskilled labor accounts for a very small portion of economic output. Other of these Senate clowns claim that immigration do jobs that natives won't do. Now, this is patently false, since many of these jobs were done in the 1970s by non-immigrants. In 1970, for example, there were fewer than 800,000 Mexican immigrants in the country. Now, even if these benefits were real, of doing jobs other Americans wouldn't want to do, they wouldn't come close to outweighing the costs. Even in our foreign immigration policy, we tend to select these illegal aliens and other groups who are not educated, who often have criminal records and are prone to criminality and prone to being on welfare, whereas we don't take educated people from around the world. It's very, very difficult, ladies and gentlemen, for a Russian citizen, and of course I'm in Eastern Europe right now, it's very, very difficult for a Russian citizen to come to the United States. It's almost impossible for a young Russian lady, even if she has a boyfriend in America, or a pending marriage. It's very difficult for them to get here. And yet our borders are wide open to countless millions of illegal aliens that come in, and they have an incredibly high birth rate, a birth rate which is absolutely going to swamp us. Now, some other notes and side notes that I want to talk to you about in terms of this immigration is the fact that right now the estimates, even the pro-immigration estimates, are that 12 million illegal Mexican aliens will be able to qualify under the new amnesty provision. You have to understand that most of these are in fact males. They'll be bringing back their Mexican girlfriends. Many of them have Mexican wives, and they'll be bringing back their children in tow. So you can double, even triple, that number. They also have the highest birth rate of any group in the United States of America, a very high birth rate. And so over the next generation or so, you're talking about the next 15, 20 years, even if the numbers of 12 million are correct, and I think that they're far too low, we're talking about 70, 80, 90 million Mexican immigrants in the United States, and the attendant costs and problems and crime and other difficulties associated with it. Ladies and gentlemen, if this alien immigration, this illegal immigration, as well as the legal immigration coming in, and by the way, the amnesty bill literally ups the illegal immigration too, I mean the legal immigration as well. What we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the United States of America, the end of our economy, our viability, our culture, our heritage, and our way of life. We're going to have a nation that far more resembles the third world, some of the poverty-stricken countries of Mexico and the Caribbean and other parts of the world, rather than the traditions and the heritage of the United States of America. I don't want that to happen. I don't want that to happen because I believe in the beauty of our people, the heritage of our people. I think, in fact, I know that we have a right to live. And we have a right to have a nation for our children that reflects the values of our forefathers. And ladies and gentlemen, we've had a great nation. We've created great things. We've led the world in many ways over the last 100 years in technology. We have created many of the greatest scientific advances and breakthroughs that we utilize every day in our lives. Whether you're talking about MP3 or whether you're talking about going to the moon or whether you're talking about cures for literally tens of thousands of ailments and diseases and problems of the human body, whether you're talking about incredible work of art and literature and music and architecture and achievement, America has created great, great things. And I believe that we have a right to preserve our country and our way of life and the distinct character of our country as it is. And ladies and gentlemen, I believe every people absolutely has that essential human right. So you see, I'm consistent. I am not in favor of American or European colonialism around the world. I'm not in favor of America having 67 bases around the world. I'm not in favor of the efforts to globalize the world in American image. And by the way, this globalization is very much damaging this world. We see it now. It's unleashed, and we have unleashed this problem around the world. There's going to be a tremendous damage to our resources, to our environment around the world, to the fact it's not only going to affect China and Africa and many South American countries. For instance, Brazil, which is in the process right now of burning down the rainforest. Now, the rainforest is not only essential for the magnificent fauna and flora that exist in that rich belt of plant and animal life, but it's also valuable for all of us. The Amazon basically filters and cleans the whole atmosphere of the earth. It really gives us clean air and oxygen, much like a filter in a fish tank would do the same to enable the occupants of that tank to survive. The world is like that. The world is like, in a way, a tank. It's a tank of air and water and land, and we have massive carbon monoxide and dioxide emissions. We have other pollutants in the atmosphere. We have a greenhouse effect going on in our world. We have a problem with the ozone layer. We have problems with global warming. And yes, I really do believe that global warming is going on. We're seeing that today in our lifetime. And the rape of our environment, whether it be in the United States or whether it be in Brazil or the third world, is going to affect the lives not only of the people in those particular countries, but it's also going to affect our own people. So I'm opposed to globalism. I'm certainly opposed to this terrible Iraq war. And I'm going to do a program soon. I think I'm going to talk to you in the next few days about some of the effects of the Iraq war. I've read a very, very damaging and shocking report from Iraq, from one of the reporters in Iraq, a filmmaker who was at one of the base hospitals in Iraq, dealing with, I think, the injuries of one of the reporters, one of the television news reporters that was injured. In fact, she just came back to the United States of America. But it describes some of the wounds of so many American soldiers and military personnel in Iraq, horrendous wounds, and wounds that are really not being suffered for America. I think any American is willing, not maybe eager, but certainly willing to die if necessary for our country, for the well-being of our people. That's what it's all about. And they're willing to take risks for that. But what's going on in Iraq, of course, is something that has nothing to do with the elemental security of the United States of America. It was a war for Israel from the beginning. It is still a war from Israel. They're trying to get us in a war against Iran for Israel. And it's a war that's hurting America in every way and driving other peoples and to hate this country and putting Americans at risk. But why in the world are we having Americans fighting to secure the streets of Baghdad or parts of Iraq when we are literally losing America at home? We have massive numbers of non-Americans, of people that have different culture, different heritage, and different characteristics than our own, who will transform our land into something that will be strange and alien to our own children. And yet we have Americans dying, and we are spending literally billions of dollars, which will escalate to trillions of dollars over time in the nation of Iraq, in pursuit of a policy that's only hurting America in every respect, in trade, in terms of the loss of lives, tens of thousands of young men and women even today that are being grievously and terribly wounded and disfigured and crippled and blinded and emasculated in this war. We are literally creating oceans of hatred against our country and against our people that will be reflected. And yet we have this long border with Mexico, a border that's being absolutely penetrated, a border where Al-Qaeda or any enemy of the United States or any other enemy can bring in biological weapons or chemical weapons or, for that matter, possibly in the future, nuclear weapons, and this border goes unguarded. And our government does nothing to defend the basic character of our nation. This is where the battle for America lies. It's on the Mexican-American border. It's in every place of immigration and customs in the United States of America. And if we don't preserve that, and we don't stop this massive immigration, and illegal immigration as well, both legal and illegal, we are going to lose everything of real value to the United States of America. Everything that we would cherish and want for our children and our grandchildren and for the future. We're in the moment of decision, ladies and gentlemen, and we have got to begin to fight this immigration. Now, some may say that I talk about these things only because of the fact that I'm a European American and I want to preserve my European American heritage. They often call me a supremacist. Well, let me tell you something. I'm not a supremacist. I don't want to rule over other people around the world. Again, I don't believe in colonialism, but I do want to preserve my own and my own homeland, and I think that every people want that. Mexico itself has very powerful immigration laws that prevent massive immigration from its southern border. Most countries of the world have that. Most of the Arab countries have that. The Islamic countries have that. And by the way, I have a great respect for our Islamic friends, and I sympathize with the Islamic situation and the Palestinian situation, as well as Palestinian Christians, by the way, one of those forgotten people that have been sacrificed on the altar of this Jewish supremacist and this evil Israeli state. So I sympathize with them in many ways, and I support their struggle. But I hope they understand that I want to preserve my heritage just as the Palestinians wanted to preserve their land, and because of immigration they've lost their land, and the same process is happening in America. Interestingly enough, the dynamics of non-European immigration, such as the great waves of the Jewish immigration in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s, which many Americans tried to stop, they didn't quite stop it in time, and the waves that came in from Europe, by the way, in the Hitler era and the era succeeding that, has really affected our foreign policies. Today, people like Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz and Joshua Bolton, who now sits in the White House as the head of chief of policy of the White House, and the very much power they have in media has affected our policy in the Middle East. If the Islamics were smart, they would realize that the loss of influence of the European Americans in America and in Europe today has really affected their immediate problems and difficulties that exist in the Middle East. And I hope that my friends out there in Arabia and the rest of the world can understand this. So, yes, I am concerned about my European heritage. I'm not concerned about only that, but I am concerned about that, and I do believe that immigration should be structured so that my heritage, our European-American heritage, the traditional heritage of America, the heritage that created the Constitution of the United States and the foundations of America, that this heritage is preserved. And without this heritage, I know that our country, as we know it, as we love it, cannot be preserved. And that same thing is true of Europe. And over the next few days here in Eastern Europe, I'll be attending an international conference on the survival and the future of the white race. Russia and Eastern Europe is essential for that. President Putin has recently made a kind of Russian State of the Union address where he said it's essential that the Russian people increase their birth rate. And that's probably that factor combined with immigration are the two biggest factors in the destruction of our heritage. And the destruction of this heritage is not simply one that's going on in America with our low birth rates and high immigration rates. It's not simply going on in England or France or Germany or Italy or Spain or Eastern Europe. It's going on worldwide wherever Europeans and Americans dwell. We have to confront this issue on a worldwide basis, and we have to get specific and concrete in terms of fighting it. If we don't begin to organize and we don't begin to wrap our philosophy and our ideology around this essential survival issue, we're not going to survive. And the beauty and the culture and the magnificence of Western civilization will, in fact, die. I look forward to being with you again soon. I can give you a report tomorrow from the International Conference, and I will look forward to sharing that with you tomorrow. I hope all of you help continue to spread the word, and all of you, every one of you listening, will support our programs, will support DavidDuke.com, will contribute to this effort, and more importantly, reach your friends and family and spread this word. Spread some links on this program around to your friends throughout the internet and throughout the world. Thanks so much, and I'll see you again tomorrow. This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.davidduke.com.